Hi, everyone. So because we have a limited amount of time before Vespers, I guess I'll just go right ahead and start. I'm Eric Davis, and I'm about as nervous as I've been in a long time standing before you today. And I'll tell you why that is, which is partly that I grew up every summer here at Holden. We moved a lot, and I wasn't an Army brat, but almost as bad. Holden was always my home, and where I came back and knew that I would find people in my community. And when I had the opportunity to come on to teaching staff here this summer, I offered them things that were well within my purview. Mm-hmm. I teach religious studies at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I focus on Cambodian Buddhism. I lived in Cambodia with my wife and children for 3 years before they were both born. And I focus on the anthropology of religion, Buddhist history, Buddhist studies. I offered meditation. And they came back with, well, what else do you do? And I said, well, all the rest of my time is actually spent doing social movement organizing. And they said, well, yes, let's do that. But of course, I'm coming now to the community that I've always associated with spirituality and religious community. And I'm going to talk about groups which have oftentimes quite contentious relationships with religion, especially with institutional forms and religious authority. And we can get to that later. But the reason I wanted to do this session first is that we've had such, in just the last few years, we've had a real efflorescence of radical social demands around the world. I'm sure you can all come up with innovative and new, well, innovative might be the wrong word, it's almost too praiseworthy, but new and novel political situations that have popped up. I mean, would anyone like to suggest one?
Tea Party.
The Tea Party. The Tea Party is a great example of a new form of political expression in the United States. It certainly has a history, and there are resonances with the past, but it's definitely a new thing on the American scene. Other ideas?
Citizens United.
Citizens United, absolutely. Another form of sort of political change that takes place at the legislative realms, right? Other
Occupy
things?
Wall Street.
I'm sorry?
Occupy
Wall Street, a very dramatic thing that is largely United States bound, but has taken its inspiration from around the world, especially the occupation of Tahrir Square in Egypt. I would say without any hope, and I hope this doesn't sound positive, but I would say that with a great deal of anxiety, we seem to be in a moment that of potential worldwide revolution that hasn't really been seen since 68. And before 68, I would say 34. Maybe there's a periodic cycle that we can talk about. I'm not sure. I'm not into universal history. But there is so much going on, and I think the crisis of our times, the crises of our times, are heavy on many people's minds, and where many of us are looking for new ways to try and address and conquer these crises. For me, I have an 8 and a 6-year-old child, and two different children, not and I am terrified about climate change, just absolutely terrified. They say that 2 degrees Celsius is now inevitable and also disastrous for the human species. And so what do we do with that? How do we deal with the crises of climate change, the crises of environmental degradation, the crises of increasing immiseration and poverty, and the loss of autonomy throughout the world, both individual and communal? And so what I hope to do to a certain extent tonight is just to offer a broad sort of survey of some of the trends, and I want to call them trends, for a reason I'll explain in a moment, in political thought and organizing that we can sort of pick out today. And the reason I want to call them trends rather than factions or movements is that many of the things we'll be talking about as particular examples in the modern period combine multiple versions of these. So you will find in the Tea Party, some people will want to call that fascism. I actually disagree. I think fascism is a much more specific thing. But there are certainly fascistic elements within the Tea Party. And there are, but the Tea Party is, in my opinion, a very definitely liberal organization, and we'll talk about that as well, because I'm using the word liberal not in contrast to conservative and not as a synonym for progressive, but instead as a way of thinking about how communities, and especially political communities, organize themselves. So that's where I'm coming from, and I hope that you will feel free to interrupt. If you need to raise your hand because you are pathologically polite, please do so. If you are more comfortable just popping off, just shout up, and I would love to take a moment to digress. One of the other things is that you never know, especially this is my first time teaching at Holden, I never know exactly where to pitch some of these things. So some of you will have much more extensive knowledge about some of these things and less about others, and we can educate each other, and to a certain extent I've given a shorter shrift to extensive definitions in an attempt to move along. But if at any point we need to stop and slow down, that's what we should do. So if you find yourself confused at any moment, perhaps you would help us by indicating bravely that there is a point on which you are not entirely clear that we can proceed to elucidate. So far, so good? Those are that's where I'm at. Okay. So we've got a number of different things up here. Anybody recognize all of them? All five icons?
Lower right?
Is that the sticking point?
Yep.
These are the fasces, which from the name you can understand is related to fascism. The fasces were the symbol of the Roman magistrate's power to punish and his authority. You could be beaten with the rods, or executed with the axe. And the fascist movement of the early 20th century, which has become emblematized most specifically by the National Socialist movement of Germany, the Nazis, but which is not limited to them by a long stretch, adopted this symbol thanks to Mussolini, who was going sort of a nationalist history back, pushing Italy back to Roman days. And the idea of those bundles of rods here is that all of the people under a fascist system must be bound together under a single authority, which can be wielded by that single authority in an effective, efficient way. That's one other thing I'm going to tell you, is that I'm going to try and be as sympathetic in the moment to each of the movements I discuss. And none of this is intended to be conversion or proselytizing. I have my own opinions, but that's not relevant here at the moment. I'm trying to simply give a context because, as I said, many of these things interweave in the actual political movements that we encounter. All right. So, and I'm sorry, can I ask your name?
Tim.
Tim, could you push the forward button for me?
What was the circle A?
Oh, can you go back one? Anarchy. Yeah, that's the that's a common symbol for anarchy, for anarchism.
You just want to scare
things. Yeah. Just troublemakers, absolutely. Just a bunch of wraparound. Yeah. So we've got anarchism. This is probably unfair to the Marxists to associate them solely with the USSR, but that's what I did. So we've got anarchists, Marxists. Both of these, the Republicans and the Democrats, I classify as liberal for the moment. Some of them are more progressive, right? And some of them are more reactionary. But in the context of the liberal state, both of them qualify very definitely as liberal. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, so modern political movements tend to be seen as responses by groups of people to what are considered the challenges and crises of modernity. Now, modernity is one of those horrible words that means absolutely nothing until you give it an operational definition. Absolutely everyone has a different meaning of modernity. For some people, modernity means the ability to buy Michael Jackson's Thriller. For other people, it means an increasing degradation of community. For other people, it means exciting opportunities, the proliferation of arts and cinema, the proliferation of literature. I would like to say that it is all of these things, because it is ambiguous, much like our lives. But there are specific challenges to modernity, and for this period, I would like to claim that modernity is most importantly defined by capitalism and the modern state. And for one of the reasons why I want to do this and say it's these two things is that it's these two things which most distinguish these different movements from each other. Their attitudes and relationships to capitalism, and their attitudes and relationships to the authority invested in the modern state form. Okay. Tim, you're awesome. All right. So the stimulus and the context. If modern political movements, especially radical ones, are attempts to really vigorously respond to the challenges of modernity, then we have to understand what modernity is and what the context is. Capitalism is notoriously difficult to define, but one of the two things I would like to emphasize is that it is a relatively new system of economic organization in human history. It is not an old thing. It is not simply greed. It is not simply the profit motive. It is not simply the rationalization of economics. It is a very particular thing. Capitalism is, for most sociologists today, largely defined by Marx. And for Marx, capitalism is dominated, and I don't include this here, by the commodity form. So what a commodity is simply something that you create for sale. Once we start there, we understand that if a commodity is the source of people's wealth, we have to understand how these commodities are produced. For Marx, and for most people following Marx, on defining capitalism, and we'll ignore Alan Greenspan and Milton Friedman here for just a moment, but we'll return to them. Capitalism is an economic system in which those who own the means of production, so these are things like factories, fields, stores, any business concern you might think of, employ other people to accomplish the work of the production of that commodity, and who then make money off of that production. In a short way, it says, if we're making widgets, right, and it costs me 5 cents to put up the infrastructure to create the widget, I'm paying you 80 cents for the labor to make a widget, but I'm charging $1 for the widget, I'm getting 15 cents off the top as profit. And the justification for that profit, for me holding on to that instead of distributing it equally among all the people who produced the commodity, is that I own the means of production. It is my private property. Therefore, I get to do what I want with it. It's not yours, you don't get to decide. It's mine. So forget it. If you want to have a job, I might hire you. But we're going to have some struggle. We're going to have some struggle over how much I pay you. Right? And you're going to want more, and I'm going to want less. One of the great advances Marx made was that he defined capitalism as something other than a conspiracy theory. As opposed to various anti-capitalist ideas which were current at the time, which identified capitalism as a almost biological disease coming in with various types of people, especially Jews. Capitalism is not a conspiracy theory. Capitalism says people who are capitalists are under very real pressures, the pressures of competition. And these competitive pressures make them act in certain ways. It's all very reasonable. If you're trying to make money and you're competing against somebody else who's making a slightly better widget, you're going to have to lower your costs for the sale of that widget. If you lower the costs for the sale of your widget, you're going to have to push the labor costs down. Meanwhile, your workers aren't going to be very pleased with that. So there's always going to be a competition. The working class and the employing class have very little in common when it comes to their workplace. And capitalism entails a transformed social world. Capitalism is one of the most revolutionary forces in human history, I would say second only to agriculture. The introduction of agriculture changed humanity forever about 10,000 years ago. Capitalism has done something almost as dramatic. And it is a freeing revolution. Marx often talked about the freedom of capitalism. Can anybody imagine what types of freedom he was talking about?
It's not feudalism.
It's not feudalism. You're freed as an individual from the slavery and bondage to a feudal lord. So there are definite forms of freedom that come with capitalism. There is also the freedom to sell yourself and your time on the market. That you sell yourself, nowadays, 8 hours a day, or supposedly 8 hours a day. Anybody here actually work less than 8 hours a day? No. But your lunch hour is now even taken away, right? So we sell ourselves, we sell our time to somebody, and we sell it to the highest bidder. Right? But those aren't the only things that encompass our the sale of our labor.
I actually have a question.
Sure, please.
On the very first slide had the USSR flag, and
yes.
That was representing Marxism.
Yes.
And this comes from Marx.
Yep.
how does that fit in? Because I don't associate USSR with capitalism. So is that with
absolutely. So the USSR is a Marxist-Leninist state. Was a Marxist-Leninist state. Definitely indebted to the ideology of Marx and anti-capitalist in form. One of the big challenges of understanding the USSR historically is that it attempted to act communist within its borders and capitalist without, by and large. And so it's sometimes we call it state capitalism, but it's a complex issue. But yeah, it's definitely vigorously anti-capitalist. Does that answer
your
question?
Thank you.
And one of the other things that happens with capitalism is that there's an intensifying competitive accumulation of capital. One of the only ways to survive as a capitalist is to constantly compete with other capitalists for more and more and more. Because the person who has the most toys at the end wins. And failed capitalists are more frequent than successful capitalists. And even successful capitalists rarely stay successful for very long.
It doesn't also depend upon pricing, but you can also lean your product to also lower the price.
You could do what to your product?
Lean your product out.
What is that?
So lean it out. So you take your steps that you create to make this part, and you reduce the steps down so it doesn't cost you as much. So you're actually making more by doing less.
Right. So the technological efficiency and organizational efficiency become very important in the capitalist system.
That can also be interpreted as lowering labor costs.
Absolutely. Right. It will lower labor costs. So the robotic revolution in the 50s was a huge blow to organized labor because all of a sudden things that were required human intelligence and nimble fingers previously were now capable of being done en masse by robots. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge challenge to traditional forms of organizing labor. Thank you. Lean, L-I-E-N.
Lean.
L-E-A-N.
Got it. Sorry, my hearing is not always super. When did it start? I don't want to answer that question. I think we can say sometime in the last 500 years.
Okay.
Tim? What did it require? It required primitive primary accumulation in the form and formally free labor. So the freedom of the individual to sell their labor on the market is an important component of it. It also required primary accumulation, which is what Marx's term, he actually used the phrase primitive accumulation, but it means basically wholesale theft of previously held commons. His example, which is quite famous, is in the 16th century of England. Previously, farmers used to have what they called commons, which is where they would graze their livestock. And without the commons, peasant farmers were not capable of living a subsistence lifestyle. They needed the commons in order to feed themselves. Along came something called the enclosure movement, which is when people from the cities, wealthy people from the cities, started buying up, oftentimes through straight theft. These were not things which were capable of being sold as property at the time. So what they did is they said, well, now it's ours, and nanny, nanny, goo, right? And they put fences around the commons, which meant that people couldn't graze their livestock on them, which meant that they couldn't subsist in the traditional means by which they had done so. This forces people to go to the cities and sell their labor on the wage market. This is happening right now in Cambodia very extraordinarily. It's just brutally obvious on the face of it. As more and more land grabs proceed throughout the entire country, forcing people who have been peasant farmers for many generations, and oftentimes living quite close to the means of subsistence, I mean, very, very bare, scarce living, forcing them into the cities and looking for waged labor.
Well, this also happened with conquering forces, like when the British invaded Ireland and
absolutely
the land and gave it to the landlords.
That's right. Any type of theft which is then used to create capital to hire wage laborers would be considered primary accumulation by Marx. That's great. So Marx's answer is that it required theft and formally free labor. A different guy's answer, Max Weber, suggested that instead it required the Protestant ethic and double ledger bookkeeping. And these are both very powerful and influential explanations of capitalism today. Marx saw the negative side of the creation of capitalism. He saw the rampant theft, the frank murder of many types of lives and ways of life, and the way in which that murder served the creation of a new form of economic organization. Weber saw something that was actually quite true. He saw the way in which, along with capitalism, people transformed their relationships to themselves. And for Weber, the fascinating thing is that he blames it all on the Calvinists. He said those darn Calvinists were so obsessed with predestination and their inability to know whether they were saved or not that they started looking for evidence all about them that they were saved, that they were among the elect. And the best way you could prove that was by living an ascetic lifestyle and working your ass off. So you work and you make a lot of money, but you don't spend anything. Hence capital accumulation, okay, which makes it possible for people to buy factories. So Weber has a very much more positive approach to capitalism than Marx does.
I'm just going to be obnoxious for a second.
Yeah.
And that I mostly agree with you, but Weber actually, I'm sure most people don't really care what Weber said, but I like Weber. He actually saw capitalism as leading to kind of an iron cage that would trap all of humanity.
That's right.
So he had that. The end result was about as bad as Marx. He also hated bureaucracies, though, so he couldn't go the communist route because he didn't see the communist state as
Max Weber is definitely, he's a depressive liberal.
Yes.
And he doesn't see anything wrong with the way in which capitalism came into being. But he sees the increased rationalization, the increased emphasis on technological efficiency, institutional rationalization, and bureaucracy as a way of changing and constraining what it means to be human. And that famous symbol of the iron cage is what Rick is referring to there. Thank you for bringing that up. It's an important point. All right. Tim, could we go back one? Yeah, there we go. All right, so the state. The other thing beyond capitalism that we need to talk about is the state. The state is also a very new form of political organization. Previously, we might have had feudalism, which would not have been territorially concrete and discrete, would not have had homogeneous rights within its territory for all people. And the state enforces a new form of political organization. The way I would like to define it for our purposes here is that it's an institutional form of highest level social authority with a monopoly on the legitimate exercise of violence in its territory, covering an explicitly defined territory. And the key for both Weber and Marx is the monopoly on the legitimate exercise of violence. When we talk about the monopoly on the legitimate exercise of violence, it means that if I punch you, I'm bad. But if I'm a police officer or a military person and I have a warrant to do so, I'm not just acting out of turn, that's okay. Violence has a place in society. Maybe we need it to discipline each other, maybe we need it to defend ourselves, but the violence has to be restricted to limited officers who represent the will of the state. And so the attitudes towards capitalism and the state are key components of what distinguish many of these political movements from each other. The state's most common response, Tim, is the nation. And we think of nationalism today sometimes as a very negative thing. Nationalism has been indicted for so many of the horrors of the last two centuries, and especially the last century, that it's hard sometimes to recall that when it emerged, it was a revolutionary and horizontal movement. It was an idea that all people who belonged to the nation should have equal rights with each other. So it was very explicitly anti-feudalist. It was opposed to differentiated hierarchies of rank and value accruing to a person. Instead, it said all people should be equal. It was a very romantic movement. It was very aligned with German romanticists, for instance. And once it was co-opted by the state, it tends towards exclusion and oppression of those outside of its boundaries. And also a very hardcore desire to sort out those within the territory of the state, those who do not belong there as members of the nation. And we can see where that sort of thing goes quite easily. There's plenty of examples of states trying to sort out its population. This is one of the issues we see with undocumented migrants all the time. We declare some forms of human movement illegal, and we sort them out. Right? One of the primary sort of texts which puts these two together is Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, in which he presents the English nation as a nation of shopkeepers. This is his lovely definition of what it means to be a member of the English nation. It means to be people who rationally truck and barter, people who know how to make a deal, and people who know how to be rational about it. And there's a certain naturalization of what it, of the capitalist impulse and the capitalist form of organization there, and a wedding of it to the national form. The next guy is Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan. This is, for Hobbes, this is the state, right? This big guy. Now, I couldn't figure out how to do this. If you look down here, there's a whole bunch of people below the white, right? And this giant Leviathan is rising out of this mass. And the Leviathan is the state itself. It's the necessity to have an authority figure, that is, the state itself, to control, manage, and direct the energies of the nation. As you can guess by the term Leviathan, it's not without an ambiguity, right? Leviathan is not always a positive note in biblical literature especially. And you can see, actually, he's made up of people, right? He's entirely made up of separate individuals who become one being in the state and the nation. Okay? So Hobbes saw a notion of humanity as inherently violent and small. The reason we need Leviathan is because without order and authority imposed from above, humanity is a war of each against all. And we are all lord of the flies, right? We're all either Piggy or the bully, whose name I can't remember right now. And it's just violent and awful, and we've descended into a state of barbarous inhumanity. He cautioned against the tendencies to excess, and even Hobbes, whose theory of the state became the most famous defense for centuries, recognized the terrible possibility of the state becoming autonomous from the people it ruled, not responsive to it. Now, in the liberal state, we typically use representative means of trying to put a check against that sort of authority escaping from the power of the nation. So we talk about, you know, our representatives sort of serving us and indeed representing us in our government. And we talk about checks and balances in the United States as a way of putting a checks on the various types of authority that governments and states try and arrogate to themselves. There's an understanding within Hobbes that authority tends to want more. Authority always wants more authority, and that tendency will have to be checked. And that one of the ways of checking that authority is through representational means. In contrast to Hobbes and the liberal tradition, we have the radical left tradition. And I'll just mention here that the terms left and right actually come from the French Revolution. It's where people with different positions within the Revolutionary Council took their places, the conservatives versus the people who wanted the revolution to go full steam ahead, wherever that led. Against these folks we have, and this is more of the dead white guy alert here, this is Charlie Marx and Mickey Bakunin. Charlie, who most people know, is a German and is one of the most famous founders of the contemporary fields of sociology, along with Max Weber and Emil Durkheim. Of course, a communist. His assumption was that the state form was bad. He didn't like it. He hated capitalism, and he didn't like the state. But the state form is necessary for a time. We cannot reorder economic relations without using the authority and power of the state, the efficiency of the state to do so. And so Marx had this idea that if communists could just take over the state, they could reorder social and economic organizational relations, and then eventually the state would, here's the joke, wither away. And it's a joke because we've seen over and over and over again that that's not what happened. You know, the USSR descended into the gulags. 100 million people are claimed to have died under Soviet rule. I have worse stories to tell about Cambodia, which I will spare you. Mickey, on the other hand, was a Russian prince who became the most famous progenitor of anarchism in the modern world, although he didn't coin the word. That was coined by a Frenchman named Proudhon, who was more of a mutualist than anything else. And Bakunin was also rabidly anti-capitalist, but was also hateful against all forms of authority exercised over other people. And his famous book, probably the most famous one, he never finished a single book he wrote. He was always in a hurry. He would start like, you know, 75% of the book and then just leave it somewhere. Was God and the State, in which he compared the religious authority of clerics who own and know what God is and means to those who would do the same thing in a political realm. It's not anti-religious or anti-God, but it is definitely and definitively anti-clerical. Marx, on the other hand, he had a very narrow view of religion in general. And Marx simply saw that religion was an ideology intended to fool the masses. He's somewhat more sympathetic to that. You've all heard the phrase opiate of the masses. What many people don't realize is that Marx himself was always on opium because he had terrible abscesses in his teeth. So he was sympathetic to the opium. Opium was what took away his terrible pain. He also had carbuncles and hemorrhoids. I mean, he was a disaster of a human being physically. And he was always taking opium, which was the most common recipe for pain ailments at the time. So we think of opium just as a bad thing now, but it was, you know, it was the fentanyl of the masses, if you will. So they agreed on capitalism and disagreed on statism. And this distinction, Marx eventually threw Bakunin out of the First International, which was the anti-capitalist group. This marks the distinction between what we might call state communists and anti-state capitalists or anarchists. So an anarchist, in contrast to a Marxist communist or someone within the Marxist tradition, is someone who opposes both capitalism and the arrogation of authority without voluntary assent. The great sociologist Emile Durkheim opposed capitalism, but he comes out of a French current of anti-capitalism, which was very unusual and idiosyncratic in a lot of ways. A rather mild state socialist, he believed that through parliamentary means we could reform the current state and oppose capitalism by reforming economic situations without real physical or political struggle. The struggle would be waged solely on a representational plane. I think that's all I have to say about Emile. I adore him as a theorist of religion. I think he's not the greatest political thinker in the world. Max Weber, again, was more concerned with the bureaucracies. And here's the Iron Cage section there. And the Iron Cage into which we have built ourselves. And he represents sort of the liberal capitalist wing of modernity, although not with verve and enjoyment. He's depressed about everything. Indeed, he wrote The Protestant Ethic shortly after coming out of a massive multi-year depression. All right, Tim, just go one more. There we go. So what are the responses themselves? There's so many that nobody could possibly do justice to them all, and so I'm just going to concentrate on a few. The one that never gets talked about is indigenism. And so I want to put that right up front. Capitalism and nation-statism are intimately intertwined with colonialism and the expansion of European powers into the rest of the world. And especially in the Americas, the resistance that has been mounted by the people into whose territory Europeans have come has recently been called indigenism. So this is just an attempt to preserve indigenous ways and organization in the face of the corrosive forces of capitalism, those things which remove from your ability to procure those things you need. So if you can't get your staples, if your hunting lands have been cut off from you, and you are forced no longer to be a hunter or a gatherer, but instead to go find work in the nearby town, right? This is a corrosive force of capitalism against culture, right? And so there's a long 500-year war between indigenous lifeways and capitalism in the modern state. We would also, by the way, necessarily define any indigenous society as an anarchist society. no indigenous society prior to the introduction of capitalism, the modern state, had capitalism, and no indigenous society had a state form. By definition, the vast majority of human history has been anarchist in organization. All right. And again, this is perhaps the longest running oppositional force in the modern world, but it is far too often ignored. Okay. Nation-statism part one, the liberal state. I've chosen this picture of Canadians cheering on their teams at the Olympics as the mildest form of nation-statism I could think of. After all, they're Canadians. It's the Olympics. And they're just, I mean, Canadians are just very friendly, right? I mean, if they're nationalists at all, they will apologize to you for it. And the liberal, again, if I can just backtrack here, liberal has very little to do with the way we normally use the word here. And I'm not trying to tell you not to use the word liberal in the way we all do every day. Instead, I'm trying to suggest that liberal here has a technical meaning. In this sense, we might want to replace the word liberal with progressive, right? So we have liberal progressives, and we have liberal conservatives. In this sense, Democrats would be the liberal liberals, and Republicans would be the liberal conservatives. Is that clear enough? Liberalism is the form we might call native to the modern wedding of capitalism and statism. So like capitalism, liberalism emphasizes formal freedoms to individuals, the ability to sell one's labor on the free market, for instance, regardless of the difference in bargaining positions between employer and employee. And Democrats, Republicans, and most of all of those groups in the United States who want to participate in representational politics must be classified as liberal in this definition, right? And so that includes most of the Tea Party, which is why it's important to make that distinction between the way we reflexively use it, liberal, in our everyday speech and the way I'm trying to use it here. On the other hand, there are political parties who are definitively not liberal. The Workers' World Party, the Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States, mostly Marxist parties, but also fascist parties. And they do exist. National Socialist Movement is a live organization in the United States and does mount candidates. So this form of mild nation-statism is one form of liberal state. Nation-statism has another form, of course, which we're all more familiar with. And that's fascism. We can go one more, please. Right. So the fascist state. To the right of liberalism, fascism elevates the principle of authority to the center of the doctrine. Fascism historically can be either pro-capitalist or anti-communist. Typically, fascist parties have traditionally not had a coherent position on capitalism, and have typically acted opportunistically with regard to it. Fascism has come in many forms, ranging from the marriage of religion and nation in Franco's Spain, the Falangist movement, to corporatist multi-ethnic national models of Mussolini in Italy, and of course the aristocratic fascisms of the Romanians and the Hungarians and German Nazism. And German Nazism, contrary and distinctive from most other forms of fascism, which is, it's important to point out, because we think of Nazism as somehow emblematic of all forms of fascism, and it is simply not. There are possibilities of multi-ethnic fascism. There are possibilities of religiously based fascism. Nazism has an organically racially based nationalism, and that is something that is relatively distinctive about Nazism in fascism. One more. And one. All right. The next version is state communism. So it's inclusive of Marxism, Marxist-Leninism, Trotskyism, Marxist-Leninist-Stalinism, Maoism, and many other factions. The strategy largely remains the same. Seize the power of the state, reorganize society through the authority of the state along egalitarian lines. Authoritarian communism has earned a pretty bad name. And it's earned it. When people in formerly communist regimes today speak the word communist, they usually mean explicitly an authoritarian, often murderous, and sadistic political organization or person. And this is true in Cambodia, to the former Soviet blocs, to Somalia, and beyond. So those of us who are anti-capitalists oftentimes find ourselves in quite a bind when we want to talk to people who share all of our presuppositions about capitalism, but abhor the idea of the word communism. For very good reason, right? So when I talk to people in Cambodia, they say "komuni," and what they mean is somebody who murders without explanation, somebody who executes without excuse, and somebody who controls your life as if you were not worth living. Right? It has no reference for them to economic theory or anything. Instead, it comes out of the historical experience of a authoritarian regime. One of the interesting things about contemporary and traditional Marxist-Leninist parties, they're usually party-based, is that they often reserve their greatest energies for intersectarian fighting among the left. So even today in Greece, the traditional Communist Party has been undercutting its allies and the socialists and the anarchists, oftentimes throwing them and betraying them to repressive police forces in the Greek state. And even more so to the Golden Dawn, which is the powerful fascist group in Greece, which is on the rise. That's for fun. Anarchism. It's extraordinarily diverse. If the only two things that define anarchism are an opposition to capitalism and an opposition to authority, then anarchism is probably the broadest thing you can imagine. The other thing that we talk about when we talk about anarchism is it's based on mutual voluntary cooperation and assent. Most of us act like anarchists most of the time. So, for instance, if you're trying to get on a bus, and you need to get on the bus because you're going to be late if you don't get on the bus, and you're worried that there are too many people ahead of you online, what do you do? Do you barge your way to the front, pushing everyone out of your way? Do you offer money to people ahead of you to let you onto the bus first? Do you converse with the people in line and say, explain your situation, and say, would it be possible for me to go ahead? The people who choose the last version are acting in a way that emphasizes voluntary cooperation, mutual aid, and basic assent, consensus. Right? And so many anarchists, because the word anarchist has become so demonized, it's just rabble-rousers and insurrectionists who want to go around vandalizing things and blowing up stuff, prefer to call themselves anti-authoritarians for that reason. There's an emphasis on consensus decision-making, direct action, and a refusal of representation. And it's the last thing that puts most people off, the refusal of anyone to represent yourself. After all, who could represent you? You are much more complex than the Democratic or Republican Party. You're much more complex than the Green Party or the Tea Party. The idea that any individual could represent you totally in politics must be fallacious. Whether we accept the limited amount of representation that is possible in such a situation distinguishes us between liberals and anarchists, frankly. And that is the end of where we are for this. And at this point, we have another 15 minutes, which is not quite as much time as I had hoped for discussion, but I got nervous. And I would like to offer a few different options to think about. And perhaps with this many people, we could break up into groups for 5 or 7 minutes. And I'm going to just do this in an authoritarian way and ask everyone up in the upper balcony to be one group. Man in the purple, raise your hand. All right. So two hands, please. That was perfect. Hand on the left, my left. You are the boundary over here, right? All right, so that's one group. Hand on the right, all the way over to Sir with the BBE shirt. Thank you. And everyone to the over here is the other group. So we've got four groups. And group upstairs, I would like you to think about what the Occupy movement looks like. You're going to probably have to combine various versions of these. Okay? How would you classify these? Are these anti-authoritarian, communist, nationalist? Are they liberal? Are they fascist? And in why and what ways? So far, so good? Okay. Group this one. If you could do the Tea Party. I would be very, very appreciative. Group the third. If we could talk about the Democratic Party, I would appreciate that a great deal. And group the fourth, if we could talk about the Republican Party, I would appreciate that a great deal. So I'm going to go ahead and start my mental timer for 7 minutes, because I think five is just not going to cut it. And I will call you back in a moment. Thank you. Tim, thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Really good.
I hate to cut short what seem like very productive conversations, but if I'm going to get you the Vespers in time, we should come back to the okay. Everybody up here.
I'm Jericho.
Hi, Jericho.
We talked about the Occupy movement. We had a few ideas. We talked about anarchy a lot and the fact that they didn't seem to be focused around a central leader or structure. We talked about communism and the redistribution of power and wealth in the 99% and the 1%. Then we got into really what is communism and what is anarchy and what are the attributes of the Occupy movement and how does that fit into either or both of those. And then the indigenous was brought in.
Can you say a little bit more about those last couple of pieces? What are the characteristics of the Occupy movement and where indigenous might come in? Or would somebody else like to pick up that thread?
Anyone else?
And could you introduce yourself? You had your hand up. Would you
like to contribute? My name is Serena. I think the indigenous came up mostly as a variation on anarchism. Prior to anarchism being just like against certain things and what it was before it had to be against, in that sense, indigenism. And they were talking a lot about, we talked about the American tribes and the way that they were kind of did operate in anarchist society. The chief would have suggestions, but it wasn't really all encompassing, and that just had to be done. That's what I got out of the session.
And in fact, indigenism has been a strong critique of many moments and places in the Occupy movement. Very early in the occupations, indigenous groups came to Occupy encampments and pointed out that they were almost all white men at the beginning, and pointed out that they were encouraging a reformation for certain types of people, but not addressing any of the challenges that indigenous groups as groups of people were facing. And so there's definitely, there's correlations and there's also oppositions in there. I'm grateful for that. Anybody else about the Tea Party, about the Occupy up there? No? Okay, thank you. What about Tea Party folks?
Brett, my name's Brett. They are libertarian capitalists, so they want no intervention with running to the market. But really strongly in the nation, so their status.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think libertarian, as we call it in the United States, libertarianism, which in Europe has quite a different meaning. In fact, in Europe, libertarianism means anarchy. But libertarianism in the United States seems to be have a very ambiguous relationship to the state. On the one hand, they don't want any regulation over anything. On the other hand, they definitely want to retain some of the efficiency and authority of the institutional form. So I think you're dead on in sort of identifying that aspect of difficulty with the Tea Party.
You did sort of point out another name for the movement, and that's paradoxicalism.
Ooh, I'd like to hear more about that.
If you look at their origins, they liken themselves to the original Tea Party people who were protesting taxation of representation. The modern Tea Party people are protesting the taxation. They want to minimize.
Right.
And they're also more self-focused, not focused on the greater good, but on the individual.
So there's a limited scope to the people they consider part of the political community that they're concerned with. And they're okay with that. Anybody else got Tea Party suggestions? Did anybody talk about nationalism in the Tea Party? Did that come up at all?
Yeah, well, we decided that the women from you that they're liberal because they
only in one peculiar sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, absolutely. In terms of their embrace of representational sort of forms, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think that they're
eager to have, when you said that they're excluding certain groups coming into the country, and so that's their nationalistic trend.
Right.
This is what we look like.
Tea Party is for good Americans.
Yes.
And that is ambiguously defined. So that good Americans could be of any race, creed, or color for some of them, or might be limited to people who look very much like me for others. Absolutely. Anything else from the Tea Party? You guys are with that? Well, they have definitely declined in their organizational power over the last year. I'm not sure we're going to hear much more from them as the Tea Party. What about the Democrats? I'm sorry?
There's Democrats 1 and Democrats 2.
Oh, Democrats 1. Sorry, yes, we split up. Democrats for part 1?
There's fairly strong trust in representational system.
Yep.
At
least hope. Yep. That's an interesting distinction. Yes, a hope, but not necessarily a trust.
And we didn't quite decide which system.
Yeah. I think the hope and the hope versus trust thing is an interesting moment, and I think we could explore that a lot and get a lot of interesting sort of responses out of exploring that apparent contradiction. Maybe some other time. Democrats too.
Come on. We have trouble agreeing on much of anything.
You sound like the Democrats.
Yeah. Terry, just in context of what you've been saying, it's a capitalist system. I think we had some consensus that it was more organized on doing things for people, using the government to do things for people,
right,
as opposed to Republicans not being so much that way.
Sure.
But within the state capitalism, it's a really different thing than the Republican Party.
I mean, there's an embrace within the Democratic Party generally of the capitalist form, of the organized representational state. Democrats tend to, like, at the very extreme progressive end, some of Democrats want to proceed towards a social welfare model, much like in Scandinavia. And other Democrats are much more, they just don't want to keep going to war, or they want slightly higher taxes and better roads and schools. And so there's quite a continuum in there. But I think absolutely the identification of them as embracing the representational form and the capitalist model seems to be pretty unanimous within the Democratic Party. Others?
Well, if I can just speak to the gentleman ahead of me.
Yes.
He was concerned that maybe corporate America is not really being held to task as well as it should be at the moment. And it seems, and I certainly agree with this person, but it seems to me that the implication in this gentleman's, whose name I don't know, statement was largely that maybe the Democrats ultimately are almost as beholden to U.S. economic interests at the private level as maybe the Republican Party. There's a slight difference in flavor and so forth. National health, Obamacare itself would not be a disadvantage to companies other than privately owned hospitals, of course, and so forth. It seems to me that maybe something along those lines might enter the description of the current Democratic Party existence.
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, the some of the despair that I hear my Democratic friends and colleagues sort of announce when they enter into the political season is that it's sometimes very hard to tell the difference between the party that they're supporting and the party that they're opposing. One example alone is that I'm pretty confident McCain would have closed Guantanamo. As a survivor of torture and a person who has always maintained a very strong stance, ethical stance against torture, I'm pretty sure he would have closed Guantanamo. He would probably also have opened a new war for us. So it's not all good. But there's definitely a lot of contradictions and conflict in there, and sometimes these groups seem much closer together than they would. I think the Citizens United ruling sort of makes that critique of corporate interest sort of dominating representational politics all the more strong.
I think you just brought up a point to belabor it here. There's their party interests that they represent, but they're still their personal interests.
Say more about that.
Well, so my daughter has Crohn's disease. We were in D.C. for Crohn's and Colitis Foundation's advocacy day on Capitol Hill. I was in 3 senator offices and 5 representatives' offices, and they were all Democrats, and I was preaching in the choir.
Right.
The people that were in the Republican offices got smacked down a lot about the...
By you?
No, by the people they were talking to, because okay. We were asking them to increase CDC's funding to from $30 billion to $32 billion, and there were 3 funding things we were talking about, and planes and bombs are more important. But we were also, well, we were asking people in the Congress to join the Crohn's and Colitis Caucus.
Right.
The but is the guy that founded it is Ander Crenshaw, a Republican out of Florida, whose daughter has Crohn's disease.
Yeah.
So you're going to see the personal interest skewing anybody's...
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you brought this up because it allows me to indulge in the one caveat that I would always like to say. When we talk about dividing human sort of ideas of political organization and economic organization in this way, we're talking about broad generalities, and every generality is a lie. Most generalities have, well, no, some generalizations are useful, right? They're lies, but they're useful lies, right? And the personal will always interfere with the general. And so you will find people who belong to a party which would typically be opposed to any increase in funding for the horrible, horrible CDC, you know, who have family members with cancer, Crohn's, MS, who are going to say, no, this actually is quite important. And so these things, these sorts of distinctions are much better in general terms and for predictive general modeling of the world than they ever are for individuals.
The NIH, not CDC.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I said it wrong.
No. Excellent. So yeah, I mean, there, you know, just as there are, has anyone ever had a nice boss? Right? It's not unusual. I've had nice bosses. But I don't imagine that as boss and employee, we have the same interests. I can go hang out with my boss and have a beer and talk about all sorts of things and get along wonderfully. When it comes to our workplace, we don't have the same interests. I want more, and he wants to give me less. And that's the difference, right? Is that there's general class-based differences which may or may not force themselves into existence at the individual level. They do at different degrees. Yeah, wonderful. Anything else from Democrats Part 2? What about the Republicans, the party of Lincoln?
Oh, we forgot about him.
You commented that the Republican Party has been changing, it seems to us, and so we defined the Republican Party as the Reagan Party, and it seemed that the tension you described from Karl Marx, the tension between the state and capitalism, is tilted a bit by the Republicans who would tend to support capitalism more than the state. So I think Republicans... certainly, Reagan would say we need less government and more freedom for capitalists.
Yeah, absolutely. Does anyone want to expand on that? Maybe you know Grover Norquist?
Yeah.
And his famous dictum that what we should do with government is drown it in the bathtub? You know, the ideology of Grover Norquist, who's still a very powerful political player, although sometimes quite behind the scenes, is really one of libertarian capitalism. It's anti-state capitalism by and large. He would really like to get rid of the state entirely. He sees it as a restriction on capitalism's unfettered power, and he sees capitalism's power as a good thing. It brings wealth and progress, etc., and egalitarianism and economic sort of sufficiency for all is a pipe dream that shouldn't be worried about, because as we get better and better and things produce, more people will be embraced by this.
But we made the very important point that fascinated me, that capitalism turned totally loose, turns into feudalism, potentially.
I think that's right. I think, you know, once we start depending on our employers for our healthcare plans, and they can be taken away the minute we are no longer employed, when we start to put more and more of the things we need for living in the hands of people who have an immense amount of power and authority over us, it starts to resemble closer and closer feudal relations. That's a great point. You know, it's interesting, the distinction between Lincoln and Reagan. I mean, of course, Barack Obama economically is more conservative than Reagan was. But Lincoln himself in 1867 commented on a Supreme Court decision which allowed, it was sort of the first Citizens United ruling. And he said that this ruling was going to destroy the ability of America to be a free state. And this was the Santa Clara Pacific Railroad ruling, which allowed corporations to be, basically to not be dechartered by the state.
Yeah. I think one of the other things that came up a lot for us discussing was how to differentiate between the ideology of the party versus the actual actions that happen in the party. And just in our discussion of things, all these other things about like social issues and different personal stories and things that kind of come in and cloud everything. Yeah. And it's so hard because there's not one view. You can kind of focus on just the capitalist aspect or the state aspect, but there's so many other moving pieces that it's hard to nail those down.
I'm so glad that you came there, and this allows me to transition out of our session here today, because I think you're absolutely correct. I think many of the ways in which we distinguish between political groups is between their ideologies, between the ideas they hold about the world they want, and not by the ways in which they go about trying to accomplish those worlds. And those are important distinctions. You can have all the right, wonderful moral ideas you want, but if you have no clue how to effectively put them into place, or you put them into place in a way that undermines the very goodness of the thing you're trying to accomplish, you're out of luck. I think, you know, the USSR is probably a good classic example of that. A group of people who, at least at an ideological way, unless we consider them nothing more than hypocrites, which is fine, you can do that. But assuming that they were people who generally wanted an egalitarian economic society, they didn't achieve that. And, in fact, they made things quite a bit worse. Their practices were very distinct from the ideas that they wanted to instantiate. And so, for me, that's a wonderful place to end, because tomorrow I'll be talking about strategies and tactics for social change. And what I'm hoping people, if I haven't scared any of you away or bored you to tears, I'm hoping that what we can do is we will decide on three or four, depending on the amount of people, challenges that we would like to imagine organizing to face, and then talk about the different strategies and tactics that would or would not be useful in getting there. So, that's my session tomorrow. I'm very grateful for your presence tonight. Thank you so much.